Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no duties or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. People Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place so all who wish to may recover from alcoholism. Therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of the great whole. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA safety card and safety in AA, our common welfare. Please join me in the serenity prayer.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Larissa will lead the steps.
I was in self-centered fear at a very young age. I didn't have words for it. but I didn't fit in, I didn't belong, nobody liked me. That might have been true or not true. At least what was going on between these two ears was that was the story I was telling myself. And I had a spiritual experience with alcohol. It changed it. And I loved it. I loved what it did to me. I loved the effect it produced in me. It gave me an identity. And I kept drinking for many, many, many years. And then consequences started. And that was frustrating because my love of my life started to betray me. It started doing things to me like losing jobs and getting arrested and going into debt, and it wasn't working. And so, you know, I set out in my bravado and in my arrogance and in my pride and in my self-centeredness to fix the problem. I can fix this. And so therapy and self-help books and gurus and gym memberships and yoga, you know, whatever, to fix what's going on inside. None of that worked. Surprise, surprise. And as I continued to drink, the more depressed I got, the more diagnoses I got from psychologists that told me how messed up I was. The more isolated I got, the more lonely I got, the more depressed I got. And in the end, I don't want to live. I don't want to live. I want to jump off an 18-floor condo down in Miami. What happened? What's wrong with me? And, you know, I'm trying to fix the problem by my own human resources. And it's not working. And it's just getting worse. And the shame and the hatred that I have for myself is worse every day. And in those moments where I'm like serious, as a heart attack, that I am done. It's over. I'm done. I will never drink again. And in the end, it was 2 p.m. And I'm drinking, and now I'm going buying cocaine, and now I'm at the strip club. You know, what happened? I had this resolve. And of course, when I drank, it was, you know, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I became, like, I had this different life that I was hiding from one group. And I was miserable. And then something even worse happened. I went to an AA meeting. And then the darkness really enveloped me. And I was like, this is the solution? You? Like this, I had to resign myself to chairs and coffee, and God, smoking wasn't around when I came, but like, this is it? As I look back at that, I was still so operating on fear, on arrogance, on self. Like, you didn't have what I wanted. I wanted shiny objects. I wanted beautiful women. I wanted all this stuff on the outside to fix this hole that's on the inside. And there was no way you were going to do it. But I had nowhere else to go. Like, I had no social. My best friend was the pizza delivery man. And he was working on Friday nights, making money. So I started to listen. And I heard things of, I heard laughter. I saw friendships. I saw brightness in people's eyes. I saw camaraderie. And there was talk of a solution, a way out of my dilemma. And so once I started hanging around, you know, I believe that when I was able to say, like, I first said I'm an alcoholic when I came in, but like, there was a point a few months in that was like, I'm Jim and I'm an alcoholic. Like, I finally knew what was wrong with me, because I had understood that I have this disease that's mental and spiritual and physical. I didn't know this. I just thought I was a total piece of shit, and I was, but I had this serious disease. And so I surrendered. I surrendered to the program. I surrendered to my sponsor. I did what he said. And fast forward, I've got 5 minutes left. I want to get to where I am now. I love AA. It continues to save my life, and it continues to change my life. But it's a process, and it's a journey, and it's painful. sometimes I wish there was an easier, softer way, but there's not. Now, within the pain, there's a joy. Within the pain, there is serenity. Well, why is there pain? There's still pain because just like I thought I had a solution to the problem of alcoholism, I still think I have a solution to the problem of being selfish and self-centered. That if I was just a little bit, be kind, you can see like this means. Just be nice, all right? I can. I can be in an AA meeting on Sunday night with friends and loving life and feeling zen and levitating. And I get home Sunday night in my apartment building. It's 9:30. Everybody knows what that means. It means quiet time. It means everybody relaxes and gets ready for work the next day. Everybody got that memo, right? Except for the outside my door, moving into the apartment, screaming down the hallway, and I am like, I would be executed in some states for my thoughts. And I lost all peace, all serenity. Why is that? Well, that's my selfish self-centeredness, and it's my self-centered fear saying, if I don't get my rest tonight, then tomorrow's going to be a shit day, a crappy day, and you know, I go through this thing. And as nice as I try to be, I just can't be it. Like, I am beyond human aid for my alcoholism and for the real problem, Jim. I can't solve it. And the frustration and the lack of strength comes in is when I try to solve it. But there's some steps called 6 and 7 that tell me what the solution is. Just as God removed my desire to drink and drug, it's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. If I think about alcohol, it's for a quick second, you know, that's not for me. But I can stew, I can beat myself up, and I can criticize myself for being pissed off. I'm pissed off at me for being pissed off at somebody else. And I'm black inside, I'm dark, I'm depressed. It's like, whoa! And I have a solution. And that solution is in the steps. And it's called humility. This program asked me to become humble. Now I knew humiliation, like I knew what that looked like. But humility, it's not, you know, nobody I think signs up for that, but the beauty of humility is this. There is a God, and I'm not him. And it's not my job to fix myself. It's God's job. If I only allow him to do it. Now, I came in, I discovered all my defects of character in 1 minute. Lust was on the list, and my sponsor said, lust is not going to go away by sitting at the strip club. What he meant by that was, there's some certain actions I got to take. I'm not going to get rid of lust if I'm downloading pornography. It's not going to happen. I want to give you this little picture. When I was a little kid, I had an older brother, we had a 10-foot basketball court, and I couldn't make the shot. I was too short. I didn't grow that much. I was still pretty short, but I couldn't make it. My brother could, so it was kind of his goal, but I wanted to make it. And I was so frustrated that I couldn't make it. Why wasn't I stronger? Why wasn't I older? Why, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I kept making a little effort. My mother came outside. She saw me making an effort, and she picked me up, lifted me, a power greater than myself, picked me up to a place that I could make that effort. And that's the program. If I just put in the tiniest effort, if I show God that I'm serious about recovery, it's been my experience that when I ask for help, not only do I get help, I get grace. And I get self-acceptance. And I get love. And I say thank you.
We will now observe the seventh tradition. AA has no dues or fees for AA membership, but we do have expenses. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, GSO has withdrawn approximately $4.5 million from the reserve fund. AA's usual suggestion is a $2 contribution per meeting. We are passing the basket, but you may also observe the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. There's a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. Again, although there are no dues or fees for your membership, we do have expenses. Our rent here is $400 per month. Please do what you can. And see our treasurer, Megan, with any questions. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight we've asked Ramiro to lead the 12 traditions.
Feeling of just relief and feeling connected to the world. for the first time, you know, I had so much fear and discomfort in social situations, and that first time I had a drink, it was like that wall between me and everyone else sort of disappeared, and I felt like I could talk to people, and I wasn't so afraid anymore, and that voice that was going on in my head telling me everything that was wrong with me just kind of quieted down, and I could just be with the person around me and talk. I went through college. I was able to graduate. I remember that when I turned 21, having that moment where I felt like for the first time, you know, I didn't drink as much in the beginning of college because I didn't like people, and I did wasn't 21, and so that meant that if I was going to drink, I had to be around people. I had to get alcohol with someone. I had to convince someone to buy something for me, or I had to work my way into a bar where they would let me drink. And I didn't like doing any of those things, so I kind of isolated at the beginning of college. But whenever I had the opportunity to drink, I would drink as much as I could. And that day that I turned 21, I remember feeling like I felt like I was in control of my drinking, like not in the way that I was thinking later that when I was trying to control my drinking, but I didn't have to rely on anyone else to drink anymore. I could drink when I wanted to and how I wanted to, and that felt like relief to me. And it wasn't until I was about 28, I ended a relationship, and that's when my drinking changed. Prior, when I was in that relationship, we were having fun, we were drinking together, it was a social thing, and that's what my drinking always was. It was social, it was a way to be connected with people. But now I was depressed and I was miserable, and I was drinking by myself on my couch every night. And I didn't necessarily think that there was something wrong with that, because that's what I grew up with, like that's what I saw my family, my parents doing. But I also saw that my life wasn't going on the track that I wanted it to. Some part of me, I think it was probably like ego or like wanting to win the guy back, was like, I gotta do something different. I need to change. Like, I need to not have this in my life. And so I started doing what I heard Jim talking about, like doing everything that I could to fix myself. Like, I knew there was something wrong with me deep down. I didn't know what it was, but I was ready to fix it. And I spent, you know, the place where my alcoholism really starts getting interesting is when I tried to stop drinking on my own. And I was able to have a little bit of success. And that little bit of success, the way that I was able to say, okay, I'm not going to drink on Friday night, and I wouldn't drink on Friday night, I thought that disqualified me from being an alcoholic, and I thought that meant that I didn't belong in a seat here, and I thought I didn't deserve a seat here. What I didn't understand is that my alcoholism was about what happens to me when I drink, or what happens to me physically, and also what happens to me mentally and spiritually, even when I'm not drinking, when I'm trying to not drink, when I'm having to control my drink. All those things are what makes me an alcoholic. It's not just about how much I drink or how many days I drink. It's about what happens when I'm drinking and when I'm not drinking. So I ended up actually in a different program before I came to AA. In this other program, I was able to look at everyone else's drinking around me and point to them as a problem. I'm really grateful that I ended up there, because for a number of years, I was able to recognize and learn about how dysfunctional relationships are when they're based on alcohol. When I'm drinking, I can't have a normal intimate relationship with the people that I care about. And that's what I was raised in. I didn't understand that that wasn't normal. But eventually, I was working this other program. I was working it harder than anyone I saw. I was desperate. I was in so much pain. And I saw the people around me getting better. And I was working so hard, doing all the things that people told me to do, taking all the suggestions. And I was getting worse. And the isolation that happens in active alcoholism was starting to crush me. Like, the more that I was able to stop drinking on my own, the less I was able to function in the world, and the less I was able to connect with people, the more that I was looking for other things to blame, like, maybe if I didn't have this job, maybe if I didn't have to deal with my family, maybe if I didn't have these friends, and I started little by little, like, getting rid of all of these things in my life. And finally, I tried like a very extreme geographical cure. I took a one-way ticket out of Boston, and I left for about a year and 8 months. And during that time, I ran out of options. I didn't know what to do anymore. And the great thing about being away, when you're in a different country that's on the other side of the world, the time zones are different. The people that love you aren't really able to get in contact with you. And I was able to really ramp up my isolation while I was away. That isolation, I felt like, was protecting me from drinking. You know, I was able to kind of control that drinking even a little bit more. And I was so resentful when people would come to visit me when I was away, because I could not drink when they were around. And I would go back to my old ways, and they would leave, and I would have that rage towards myself, which I can identify as a compulsion to drink, just how much I hated myself, like I couldn't tolerate that feeling, and the only way to get out of it was to drink. That was all I understood. And eventually, running out of options, running out of money, like, I didn't know what to do anymore, and I ended up in an AA meeting. And I thought it was just going to be for like a month to get through this situation, to get myself home and sort of situate myself there and figure out what the next steps were. But I went to my first meeting, and I left that meeting, and I said, you know, I think I might be an alcoholic. And I broke down, and I wasn't expecting it because I didn't really believe it. But someone said to me, if this is your reaction to saying those words of an alcoholic, maybe that means that there's something behind that. Why don't you keep coming, and why don't you keep not drinking, and see what happens to you, see what happens to your life as you're able to put more time together and keep showing up here. That's what I did, and I came home, and I went to my first meeting here. It was in Boston. I was in North Shore at the time. And I met my sponsor, and I didn't really know she was my sponsor for the first 6 or so weeks that we were working together, but she told me she would read the book with me. And so we would sit before the meeting and just read the book together, and then I started asking questions about the steps, and she started explaining it to me. And it still took me a really long time to identify what was happening to me with alcoholism. But luckily, I just kept coming, and I just kept listening. And there was one meeting that I went to where someone said, if you are sitting here in the seat sober today, you should have a smile on your face and a skip in your step and be grateful to be here. And I was so angry. I was in so much pain, and I was in so much misery, and I knew that wasn't me. And, you know, I heard Jim talking about the laughter. Like, I saw the laughter, and I thought that disqualified me too, because I was never going to laugh like that. I was never going to be happy with that, like that. Like, clearly, whatever I had was different from what you had. But I could imagine for the first time, when I heard that guy say that, I could imagine being happy. I wasn't happy, but I could imagine that maybe someday I could laugh. And that's when it hit me that if the solution to Alcoholics Anonymous was working for me, maybe that meant I was an alcoholic. And it was through that process that I began to listen in a different way and hear what I was hearing from my sponsor and actually believe it instead of just sitting there and nodding. And I was not willing to do the ninth step. There were certain amends that I was not willing to make. Someone gave me the suggestion that you can go ahead and totally not do step 9. You can do the rest of the steps up to that point with as full thoroughness as you can, and just deal with 9 when you get there. And so I was able to do the other steps. And by the time I got to 8 and 9, I was a year sober, and I had this idea that like getting a year sober was going to change everything. Like, people kept like making this big deal out of being a year sober. I thought that my life was going to get better once I hit a year. And what happened was, I hit a year sober, and things got worse. And I had this idea that maybe my life would be easier if I moved back into my car. Like, that felt like a really reasonable option. And when I said that in a meeting, I got surrounded. Thank you. And that's when I became willing to finish the steps and do my 9 step. And I'm so grateful that I did, because my experience of going through the rest of the steps changed not so much the way that I see myself, but the way that I interacted with the world. Like, I now no longer felt like I had to isolate to stay sober. I felt like I could be a part of the world and connect with people and not drink. And it was the first time that I was able to feel that and allow myself to like be witness in the world. Yeah, I'm really grateful to be sober today. I'm grateful to be in a meeting today. Like, I know the things that I need to do to stay sober and to stay like able to connect with people in the world. It's kind of simple, but it seems like a lot sometimes when I put together the prayer and meditation, going to meetings, talking to people on the phone, working with newcomers, and being of service in groups. But when I think about how much time and energy and effort I put into trying to survive in the real world before getting here and being sober, like, it's a very small proportion of the time that I was putting in. So I'm grateful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Erica. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator, Ramiro, after the meeting. Now let's welcome our main speaker, Ken C.
Thank you. actually have a problem being too tall for the mic, so this is good. How you doing? My name is Ken C. I'm a grateful alcoholic in recovery. I'm a member of the East Milton Group. My sobriety date is March 31st, 1991. First thing I want to say is happy birthday to my friend Phil. He's a good birthday guy. It's his birthday. Another thing I can't stop thinking about is Romero's shirt, because my birthday is April 15th. And April 15th, 1985, I can tell you a 30-minute drunk log on that night. Hagler, Marvin Hagler versus Thomas Hearns. I remember that Hagler knocked him out in the third round, and I don't remember much after that, because I know I was 16 years old and I was blackout drunk. And anyway. My home group is the East Milton Group. We meet tonight at 8:30 to 10. Last time I spoke at the speaking group, we met on another night. And so I tell people, I was taught in my group, and I'm always saying the sponsees of mine, you know, mission group, if you're dead, you know, and here I am. I'll get there before the end of it. I think this is an all right reason to miss. Man, 30 minutes to talk. I was at an AA meeting in California once, and they, asked if I'd like to share, and I said, sure, and then they said, you'll be the hour speaker. I said, like hell, I can't talk for an hour, and I said, I'll be the bad attendant speaker, too, but my group is a very big group, so, like, for my whole time in sobriety, you go on commitments, and there's usually a ton of people, you know, so you're trying to give the short version, so I guess it's nice to be able to tell my whole story, because it's important to me, and it's special to me. And it's special to me for a couple of reasons. One, because thank God, since I was fairly new at AA, I haven't had to change my story. You know, a lot of life has happened, but I've been able to stay sober, and I'm so eternally grateful. But having drank for 10 years and being sober for 32, I'm going to try to keep the drunk along in that, you know, fraction as well. And I need to tell you a little bit about my drinking, that I picked up a drink shortly after my father committed suicide when I was 11 years old. It was just me and my mom. And she cut hair out of our, we had this little house, and she cut hair. It was two rooms. The kitchen was where she cut the hair. The living room was where I watched Bugs Bunny and the four ladies sat under those old-fashioned hair dryers staring at me, and I could not wait to, you know, not be there. And I ventured to the park down the street and did what kids do down the park. The 11-year-old looks at what the 13-year-old's doing. He can't wait to do that. And I did that, and the minute I picked up that drink, man, every ounce of anxiety, pain, doubt, fear was like gone. I just wanted to feel like that for the rest of my life. And I would do anything, and I would put chasing that feeling above everything else in my life, not knowing it, you know what I mean? And I remember, like, you know, the rest of my friends were all drinking with me, but like at 11, 12 years old, even into maybe 13, they'd be like, go out on a Friday night, we'll spend half hour waiting outside the packy, and if we don't get a buyer, we'll hang out and go home a little early. And to me, I was ready. I was out on like a Wednesday night looking for a buyer to hide the beers and to ice them, you know. And if I didn't find a buyer, I was just like devastated, because I wasn't going to get that feeling, you know. And everything alcohol did for me in the beginning, it ended up turning on me tenfold. It shaped me into the person I don't think I was meant to be. A liar, a cheat, a thief. Angry, chip on my shoulder. And I went from like being a kid. I have this picture. I was already drinking, but someone sent me a picture of my freshman year at Catholic Memorial school photo. And like I said, I was already well into drinking, but I don't know why. And I look like this innocent kid, and then they sent me my sophomore school picture, and I was like, oh my God, this guy's on his way to jail, you know? And, the freshman was hiding pretty good, because I was already 3 or 4 years into drinking. But anyway, I just, you know, I just became just my mother's. What happened? The angriest kid in the world, you know? And I just had me and my 30 friends. I never wanted to, you know, meet 31, and that's how I lived life, and I was just sheltered and angry. And I say this because, to tell you where I've come in Alcoholics Anonymous, wholly as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sent to AA by the courts multiple times in my mid-teens. And I did come to AA, but, you know, like I had to, some couple of meetings or whatever, and I just remember being like, whoa, this is wild. These people are losers, you know what I mean? Like, who would do this and tell people what's going on in their lives? And good for them, though. I might come back here when I'm 60, you know? And I was having all kinds of pain and all kinds of trouble and, you know, involved in all kinds of other things I don't talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, the substances and stuff. And, my mother had since moved on and opened a little hair salon in West Roxbury, and this girl that worked for her, my mother, you know, broke her anonymity accidentally or whatever, didn't know. And she said, you know, Mara is 2 years sober at AA, and she was 17. I was like, well, Ma, I've been to AA. Nobody's sober 2 years and 17. And this girl ran my mother's business. Like, she was a witch, you know what I mean? And I was like, an alcoholic that, you know, has her act together? And like I said, I was 21 at this point, and I, after one of those nights, like so many other nights, and I had had way bigger outside problems, but I was out on like a 3-day, you know, thing, and I was, anyway, that morning I hit a bottom, and I called Mara, and I said, hey, I'm an alcoholic, and my mother said you go to AA. She was like, oh, yeah, I do. So does my brother Brian, and I knew her brother Brian. And I was like, Brian's sober? Because he seemed kind of like someone I drink with. And I didn't think he could be sober. And so she arranged for me to go to this young people's meeting in Rosendale called the New View Group. It's not there anymore. And it was a beginner's meeting. And the topic of the meeting was, what do you do socially in sobriety? And I walked into a meeting now, and that was the topic. I'm like, get in the book, you know what I mean? Like, what's that got to do with saying sober? But it does, and it had, especially when you're young, you know? And people were talking about trips, jumping out of the plane, chasing their dreams, laughing. I had no idea. People laughed in sobriety and had lives in sobriety. I was blown away. And I immediately wanted what you people had. And there was 3 or 4 people I knew in the hall that I drank with at periods of times. They were there, and I was like, wow. And I firmly planted 1 foot in AA that night, you know. And that was early 1991, and I got 29 days, 3 times in a row, and relapsed after 29 days. Why that was my number, I don't know. But I wasn't grasping a day at a time. I wasn't getting involved. I was just coming, you know? And Brian, who became my first sponsor, was, you know, he probably talked about a lot of good stuff in sobriety, but one of the things that I heard him say once was, if you're a thief, you'll be a better thief sober. And I was like, I like that. And but like, whatever attracts you, you know what I mean? They say there's a wrench for every nut in here. And like, no, you know, you can't get thrown out of AA. And so I would relapse, and I would call Brian, I would go see my old friends on the relapse. It'd be like 4 a.m, and we'd be up talking all night, and after we talked about Angler Hearns and every punch thrown, then we solved the nuclear crisis of the 80s or whatever else. We ran out of war stories. I'd start saying things like, you guys, we need to go to AA. And that is a lonely place to be. When you're talking about AA to people getting high on a relapse, that's danger, don't wind you around. And I would call Brian the next morning, and I did it again. He goes, you're going to call me before you pick up. And During this time period, so my last night in doing that, I went back to this meeting in High Park, at 10 a.m., and I was that guy that was like, couldn't hold a cup of coffee, shaking, just losing it, you know. And I stayed up the whole day, and I went to a 5 o'clock meeting that night, and in the back of the room, I had never got a chip or any of that stuff in sobriety or done anything, you know, to attract attention to myself. And Brian, I hadn't even told Brian I relapsed yet. And he just saw me in the back, and they called the 24-hour chip. He got, Kenny! And the whole meeting turned and clapped. And I went up and got the chip. And that was like the first of many spiritual awakenings in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. As I came down feeling like, honestly, it might as well have been the Grim Reaper about to chop my head off, because that's where I thought I was in life, walking up to that podium. But when I got the chip and I turned and I started to walk back, and I saw everyone's faces, and it was just that gentle smile, not laughing at me, but in that one smile it said so much. It was like, we're here for you, we've been there, we know how you feel, you're gonna be okay. But all that, just one look. And a couple of guys stuck out their hand and said, two statements I'll never forget. One was, you never have to feel this way again. And another one was, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And that sounds so simple and so obvious. But I was so bogus and damaged. I was like, wait a minute. I think I understand that. And so after that meeting, Brian said, have you been asking for help? I've been in Catholic school my whole life. I didn't believe in God. I just didn't believe I was worthy of God. So all these people that live in good lives, why would he help them? Why would he help me? And Brian said, why don't you let us worry about that? You just take the action. Get down on your knees. Ask God to remove the obsession for alcohol and drugs. At the end of the night, if you're successful, say thank you. And I did that. That was the second spiritual thing. I got to say, the obsession, that was, you know, when I would get that 29 days of relapse, it would just double every day, to the point where I felt like I was just going to like explode if I didn't go out. And that obsession was gone. I don't know. I'm not a holy roller. You know what I mean? But it was gone. I had the desperation, I guess, and I asked from the bottom of my heart, and I received it. Would it have stayed like that forever if I didn't take further action? Probably not, but my actions in AA helped to grow that relationship with God. So I got into two groups in my first year, and I one of the groups, the East Milton group, I've been in since I was 6 months old. And I got jobs in that group, they gave me the greeter, it's a huge group. And you know, I felt like I knew everyone in AA. They made me the secretary. At one point I was still acting like an idiot outside of AA. And a black eye, I'm up there reading the secretary's report, and people kept going, you know, welcome back. I'm like, I didn't drink. Like, I was proud of that. Because in reality now, I'm like, it would have been less embarrassing had I drank. You know what I mean? And my sponsor at the time, Brian, I moved in with him, and I owed the drug dealer about 10 grand, and I owed the bookie, who was my neighbor. And I had to climb out my side window of my house so he wouldn't see me come out the front door. I owed him 10 grand. I told Brian my tale of woe. And then, like a good sponsor, he said, well, why don't I squat you some money to buy a couple of ounces of coke and just sell it till you get out of debt? Like, that is the worst sponsorship advice ever given in AA. I in no way, shape, or form recommend that. But as I said, there's a wrench for every knot. And it worked for me. And I was 12-stepping people. And my friend Desi, who's sober 31 years, so it worked. I would be over his house, weighing up my drugs and cutting them up, and talking to him about AA at the same time. And then at one point I had Desi in the passenger seat, my friend Pat in the driver's seat of a truck, me in the middle, and we're driving after a meeting so they can take me to sell some of the cocaine. And I'm talking AA, and Pat lights a joint, and passes it across me to Desi, and I said, what are you guys doing? I'm like, smoking a joint. I said, we were going to meetings together for like a month. They thought you guys were sober. And they were like, we're trying for you to sell cocaine. Who are you to be lecturing us about smoking? Yeah. My point is, it was the blind leading the blind. And I thought no one in AA even knew about my behaviors. One kid I was selling drugs to, was his brother was in my group. And I'd be selling it to him going, I'll tell your brother, he's in my group. He's like, yeah, of course not. And like, they all knew. But they were just trying to buy me time, you know, so I could figure it out. And I'll always be grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous for that. They were waiting. And alcoholics have that uncanny sense of like when to hit us with the facts, you know? And I was in a step meeting, trying my best. Like I said, I was in a step meeting. And I went up to the chairperson afterwards. They just had this moment of clarity. And I said, I was about 9 months old. And I said, hey, I'm not like living a sober lifestyle. I'm physically sober, but I'm not living a sober lifestyle. I said, well, what do you mean? And I told him. And prior to that, a few people that did know, aside from my sponsor, who just wanted this investment back, they would say, like, progress, not perfection. Keep coming. And I was kind of expecting to get that from this guy. He sharpened his finger, stuck it in my chest, and said, if you do not change the person you brought into Alcoholics Anonymous, you will drink, and that's a fact. And so, like, I didn't change my behavior by some desire to be a better person. I was still selfish, and life was getting good, and I did not want to lose the good things that happened in my life. And I took that leap of faith, and I think it was partially also, like, I was, like, addicted to the chaos of life, too. And that was, like, that last step for me, like, oh, if I just go all in and AA, it's kind of boring. But if you don't go online in AA, you can't really have the true miracle happen. You know what I mean? Where, like, if you said to me, if someone outside said, is it boring? I said, there's nothing boring about it. And they'd say, why? How? And I'd say, I have no idea. But I'm all in, so it makes sense. You know? And but it allowed me to truly avail myself to another alcoholic. It allowed me to get much more honest with myself. And it allowed me to stop hanging around in places where that will lead to a relapse. And I got into, I really got into the middle of AA. And I learned from like legends in AA. People were so kind to me. They did so much for me. My friend Phil here, we've been friends for 30 years or more. And I remember when my grandfather died in early sobriety. And it was like, he was like my hero. And I don't think I had cried since my father died. You know, I was just that bottled up. And I remember Phil and another kid, Michael, spending that whole day with me, you know, and we went to the Elstree meeting that night, and just, but that's just how Alcoholics Anonymous has been to me the whole time, you know? And it's just been like, another thing, I could not and would not speak in public. Like, one of the things, remember I told you, like, alcoholism turned on me tenfold? Like, I started to develop all these, like, irrational anxieties, like so many of us do. Here I thought, when I first picked up the drink, I'm free. I got no fears, I got no anxiety. Around seventh grade, like, if you call on me in school to, like, read or talk, I would freak. I wouldn't do it. And you couldn't shut me up outside of school, but you know, in a formal setting, I couldn't do it. Fear of public speaking. Come to find out, everyone has it. But I mean, I really had it. I remember I went on my 90th day sober, I went on a commitment to the Faulkner Hospital group with my sponsor. And if you're in an open group and you got 90 days and you don't want to speak, don't go on a commitment with your sponsor. And you know, like, the whole way over, I said, call me, you can't call me, you can't call me. And, of course, he called me first, and I said it quick. God help me in this kind of same way I'd asked for a miracle to the obsession of alcohol. I went up and I spoke. I think I only spoke for 2 minutes. But I sat down with a feeling of like, oh my God, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can do anything. And I really did. I felt like this freedom. Within 3 months, I had been freed from that overwhelming obsession to drink, and I had been freed from one of the biggest fears I had in the world. And then within 6 more months later, I was freed from the prison I had of, like, the whole lifestyle I led, you know? And what do I do to stay sober, and what did I do to grow from there? Open AA was a big part of my sobriety, service work, and being in the middle of AA, going to step meetings, and doing the best I could to do the steps. And about 15 years sober, I hit an emotional bottom, Southern California, and I asked a friend that I respected a lot, who's only sober a couple of years more than me, if he'd take me through the steps through the book. He said, yeah, I'd have to be a sponsor. And I said, I got a sponsor. He said, well, who is it? I said, this old guy in my group. Well, he's actually not even in my group now. He retired to the Cape. Did you talk to him a while? Well, a couple of times a month, you know? He said, well, it sounds like he might need a new sponsor too. But anyway, I got a new sponsor. It's interesting that on this meeting, I was adhering to group conscious saying, I'm Ken C, alcoholic, because I was Ken C, alcoholic addict for the first 15 years of my life. And I got a sponsor from California who said, we had our lineage of sponsorship, which by the way goes back to the Pacific group, which is the sister group to the Atlantic group, which I'm pretty sure you're the sister group of the Atlantic group. And he said, our lineage of sponsorship, we identify by our full names in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I think they murdered me in my group if I identified by my full name. And I went back, and there was definitely a change for my group members. But he said, we're not anonymous in an already anonymous program. And so I went from Ken C to Ken, to Los Angeles. It was weird. Major change for me. So to not say it's kind of weird. But anyway, he gave me a whole 15 years sober. No work that I had been doing in the previous 15 years. A lot more reading, you know, a lot more intense work with my sponsees. Different things like meeting at least 2 people. A lot of my support group from early sobriety had moved, you know, maybe you actually moved, you know, a few towns away, but we didn't see each other every night like we always would in the past. So some people took jobs, some people relapsed, whatever it was. And so my support network was kind of old timers were dying, and when someone would come in new, yeah, they were like needed or had a detox, but you know, if it was someone I didn't, my group was, my sponsor said, I want you to shake hands with at least 2 people, at the very least 2 people, if you don't know at every meeting. And I started doing that, and man, that fear that I didn't even know I had, this fear, but like, to have my hand out, reopened up Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, call at least 2 alcoholics every day, not on your immediate, like calling about the Red Sox kind of calls, like people you don't normally call in your group. I started calling people. I called this one older guy that I sat beside in my group, Rick. And I had sat beside him, but it's a big meeting. And, hey Rick, how you doing? Good. And, you know, and someone interrupts and you have a 2 second conversation for 30 years. And I started to call him. And our friendship, like, went to this totally different level. And no one ever said, like, why are you calling? They always say, oh my God, thank you. Like, I needed that, you know, it's just... And so anyway, the message there is just like, the advice of staying, that I received to stay sober, you know, get in the middle of AA, have a sponsor, ask for help, you know, in the morning, say thank you at night, you know, go on commitments with your group, be in the steps, you know, be working on prayer and meditation, always have your hand up to a newcomer. All those things that I was taught in AA, you know, have really served me well, but they've served me like so well beyond just sobriety. Served me so well as a person. You heard my description of how it was before AA. And my mother would always say, you're the most narrow-minded, selfish, small. Your world is so small. And I'm like, yeah. And I never like left 128. And now I like for work, I travel all over the world. I go to meetings all over the world. I have sober friends all over the world. I was just on that meeting app, and somehow I got into, I was changing my location to search for a meeting, and all of a sudden, my search history and the meeting came up, and I was like, holy crap, like the places I had been in the world looking for meetings. I remember back in the old days when I would have to mail to World Service in New York and ask for like the book for like people's phone numbers to call someone in the country and ask like, can you tell me where the meetings are? And now we have an app that tells you, you know. And I've been to meetings all over the place. I went to a meeting one time in New Zealand. I like to tell the story because it kind of represents how far I've come and my personality. I called Central Service from a hotel in Auckland, New Zealand, and the old timer answered the phone, and he said, where are you? And I said, I'm at this address, this hotel. And he said, look out the window. Do you see a little bald guy on his phone? I said, yeah. And he said, come down, that's me. And I went down, and he was an archivalist, American, living in Auckland, New Zealand. We had a great conversation. He said, there's a great meeting down the street. I go to the meeting, and the greeter is this giant Maori Indian. If anyone's ever seen the movie Once Were Warriors, they have like the tribal face tattoos. Their culture is riddled with alcohol, you know? There's a lot of Maori Indians at the meeting. And I walk up and he's the greeter. And as he shakes everyone's hand, he's giving them this little nose kiss. And I'm like 10 people deep, but we don't even hold hands in the smoking room, you know? And I'm like, oh man, how bad do you want this? I'm about to give this guy a nose kiss, you know? And I get up to shake his hand, and he must have known by the look in his eyes, and he shakes me in, and immediately says, don't worry, we already do that to each other, to the other Maoris. And it was an awesome meeting. My point is, you know, from that sheltered person, you know, I've been all over the world, and I really have that belief that I can go anywhere, and I can do anything because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the gift that's been given to me in these halls. And I've got to wrap it up. Thank you.